Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Versus History. I am Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and with me as ever is co-editor at Versus History, Patrick O'Shaughnessy. How are you, fella?
I'm very, very well. What a lovely day it is here today, Elliot. The temperature is beautiful.
It is beautiful. It's about 42, 43 degrees in sunny Bahrain. And where are we right now?
Fortunately, it's not 42 degrees where we're doing the podcast. We're in a nice air-conditioned room in a lovely Arabic cafe, our favourite spot.
Yes, Patrick, now, I'm very, very interested in the topic that you have chosen to speak to us about today. Now, before we get on to that, it's just a reminder of the format of today's podcast. The last few podcasts have seen us discuss issues of particular interest in a 15-minute time window. So I'm going to be firing a number of questions at you, Patrick, and you're going to try to answer them on today's topic, which is what?
It's an emerging interest. It's not something I claim to be an expert in, but it's something over the last sort of year or so I've become increasingly interested in. It's the War of 1812 between Great Britain and the newly formed at that point United States of America.
Okay, right. Before you go any further, because I think what we need to do is we need to set some... I need to ask the most obvious question. But before we do that, I'm going to take the view that I know nothing about this. Okay, so my questions are going to come at you as if I don't know anything about this. So I'm going to ask the first question, and I'm going to give you a free 30 seconds. I'm going to ask the first question, which is, what is the War of 1812, and can you set it in some context for us so that our listeners and myself can understand it?
Yes, of course. I'll do my very, very best. Now, it's the War of No Name, really. That's why it's called the War of 1812. Any war named after a year, probably not the top of the public consciousness or historical consciousness. So that's why it's called the War of 1812, often known as the Forgotten War. Lots of us know about the American Revolution,
yep,
the Napoleonic Wars, then the American Civil War. Well, the War of 1812 sort of comes slap bang in the middle of that during the Napoleonic Wars. So it was a war between Great Britain and America between 1812 and the very, very end of 1814. The final battle of it actually occurred in 1815, the Battle of New Orleans. It's largely been forgotten about. For British people, I suppose, the American Revolution, very, very important. Napoleonic Wars of huge domestic significance. We've got Trafalgar Square, Waterloo Station.
Sure.
You know, those sort of names roll off the tip of the tongue and they're ingrained in sort of the British DNA, I suppose. And then for America, if we look at sort of their historical trajectory, American Revolution, extremely significant, gave birth to their nation.
Yeah.
And then we have the Civil War, hugely significant. War of 1812 somehow gets forgotten, but it's hugely significant because the American anthem came out of that.
Okay. Well, don't go too far into its significance, because I just want some background. But just a little aside on the context, because I'm wondering, if this is in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, is it linked to the Napoleonic Wars? And if it is, why is it that we're fighting in America? Why is it Britain in North America?
A really, really good question. Okay, so let's take it from 1783. The Treaty of Paris is signed between Britain and America. That grants the 13 colonies of America its independence, and America is a new nation. Britain still has some interests, though, on the American continent, namely Upper and Lower Canada and the Caribbean, just off the east coast of America. So after the American War of Independence, Britain still has some interests in America that it desperately wants to defend. And America's a burgeoning new nation trying to find its way in the world. Now, Britain, by this point, its attention really had shifted wholesale to its international conflicts with France, the Napoleonic Wars. So that is really where the British focus was.
Right.
So we really must look at this as a sideshow for Britain.
Right.
However, once the Napoleonic Wars are done and dusted and Napoleon has been deposed, Britain then shifts its whole focus towards the very end of the War of 1812 to America.
Okay, all right, understood. Right, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start the timer here before I ask, so we've got the context there, before I ask my first real question. So you've got 15 minutes starting now. Okay, first question is, why are we talking about this? Why should anyone care about learning a little bit about the War of 1812?
This is America's first war. This is the first time America declares war on anyone. Obviously, it will declare war a lot, and if after that, and if we think about America today, it's got huge sort of global involvement, but at the time, it didn't. It was really trying to make its own way. So that's the first reason. It's historically significant because it's the first time America declares war. You could also say it was the last time the American homeland was attacked, because the British obviously attack Washington and they burn down the White House.
Ah, this is of particular contemporary significance, because didn't President Trump accuse the Canadians about 2 weeks ago, Trudeau specifically, of actually burning the White House down in 1812?
Yeah, it wasn't in 1812, that was a bit later on in 1814, but the White House was definitely burnt to embers at that point.
But not by the Canadians.
Not by the Canadians, I suppose. If we're looking at, I mean, in terms of Canada at the point, it was run largely by Britain, from Britain,
sure,
and manned by British white settlers. There were some French in Lower Canada, but really, really significant for that point. And out of this comes the American National Anthem, with which we are all familiar. Not many people know that the actual content, the thing they are singing about in the American National Anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, is the attack by the British on Fort McHenry in Baltimore, where the British shelled Fort McHenry for about 24 hours. And the Americans were worried they were going to lose the fort and their nation would crumble. But they woke up in the morning and the flag was still there, and the British gave up on it. It wasn't the last battle of the War of 1812, but it's largely the most significant because the anthem comes out of this.
I did not know that. So the national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner.
Star Spangled Banner, written by Francis Scott Key. It's actually set to a British drinking song, so British people would have been familiar with the melody of the American National Anthem, far more maybe than their American brethren.
It's a British drinking song.
British drinking song.
Marvellous.
But the Americans set their own words to it, Francis Scott Key. So
marvellous.
The American anthem is all about the War of 1812.
Fantastic. I did not know that. Okay, here's a question for you. Whenever we talk about any kind of major event, we need to find out how it came about. So can you tell me some, maybe two or three of the key causes of the War of 1812?
Yes, okay, so leading up to the War of 1812, we really have to look at it through the lens of the Napoleonic Wars. Britain and France were at each other's throats. This was a war for national survival between them. Now, Britain and France were very, very keen to ensure that the other country in that relationship didn't gain an advantage in trade. And that included blocking American trade with each other. So what happened was, in 1807, there is something called Orders in Council, where the British essentially say, this is aimed at the Americans largely, that anyone that wants to trade with our enemy, France, well, you can't do that, and if you want to, you have to pay us a tax first.
Right.
Now, just prior to that, in 1806, the French had done something very, very similar. They had said, essentially, no one can trade with Britain. So Britain and France were trying to basically squeeze the other one out, using America as like a pawn or a proxy.
Okay.
So the Americans were being, I suppose, battered about and treated of as a sort of second-rate minnow of a power. So they were subject to the fluctuations of this war.
Huh.
Now, because Britain needed sailors, one of the key causes of irk and anguish in America was impressment by the Royal Navy.
Ah, yes, yes.
After the 1805 Battle of Trafalgar, when Britain had won sort of domination of the seas, you might think, well, Britain now rules the waves, why does it need American sailors? Well, it needed them because the Napoleonic Wars were not yet won. Napoleon still dominated the continent. So the British needed sailors. The Royal Navy wasn't, I would suggest, wasn't one of the best careers at the time. They had to literally force people into it.
So when you're talking about impressment, you're talking about the forcing of people into the Royal Navy again. Against their will.
Yes, so the British forced essentially American sailors, or anyone they considered to be British, into their own navy. So the British would stop American ships, largely merchant ships, but they would stop them, board them, and they would take off anyone they considered to be British. This was particularly annoying for the Americans, because there were lots of British people that had gone to America and then considered themselves to be American, but the British did not accept that as a way out of joining the Royal Navy. If once British, always British in the British eyes.
Huh.
That was really scoffing at American sovereignty.
Okay.
That's how the Americans saw it.
So that's one of the causes.
Yes, and one interesting, the sort of battle cry was free trade and sailors' rights.
Huh.
That was the motto or mantra of the War of 1812.
So that was the no taxation of without representation of the War of 1812.
Yes, and it's now become free trade, because the Americans want to be able to trade freely with Britain and France. They don't want anyone blocking them in, which the British and French were doing, and they want sailors' rights. They don't want their sovereignty being infringed upon by the British seizing their ships at will.
Okay.
The sort of most noteworthy aspect before the war, in the lead up to, was 1807, the USS Chesapeake and HMS Leopard. HMS Leopard essentially attacked USS Chesapeake and took off four American sailors and fired broadsides at the Chesapeake and impressed four of the sailors from that boat, one of whom was British. So the Americans felt that they were not being treated with due respect and their sovereignty was being scoffed at by the British, and they suspected that the British, well, in de facto terms, they weren't really honouring the 1783 independence of America.
Right, okay. How did the Americans respond to that, though?
Well, it was very, very difficult, really, because not everyone in America wanted a war with Britain.
Yeah.
If we think about the American Revolution, we think about the hotbed of discontent, the hornet's nest of rebellion. We think of New England Patriots. Actually, interestingly, the New England area, they were not behind this war. Sort of a complete volte-face, if you will.
Right.
They wanted to maintain trade links with Britain and France and the continent. So in terms of this war, it's a tough one. Thomas Jefferson, who was president between 1801 and 1809, and protested. But then we have President Madison from 1809 to 1817. So one of the key reasons for this war was British, and especially British, but also French, attempts to dominate American trade.
Okay, all right. So they're being squeezed, the Americans, by both the French and the British. When was the attack on the Chesapeake?
That was 1807.
1807.
Interestingly enough, this is going to the legacy. Chesapeake was eventually captured by the British during the war and became HMS Chesapeake.
Ah.
Now, if you want to find some of the beams of the Chesapeake, in 1819, I think it was, they took HMS Chesapeake, they sold it off, and now the beams are used in a mill in Hampshire. Not Hampshire, New England. We're talking Hampshire in Britain. So some of the beams were used and can still be seen today.
That's phenomenal. Right, you're doing very well for time. You have 7 minutes and, 7 minutes exactly now. If you were to choose two or three key events of the War of 1812, what might they be?
It's really difficult because it's like a sporadic ad hoc war. Bits happen all over the place, but not necessarily in a nice linear line. So I will pick out first and foremost the American invasion of Canada. Jefferson had said and thought that the British settlers in Upper Canada were essentially there for the marching. They thought they would invade and the Canadians would gleefully and happily become Republicans. That didn't happen. The American army really and truly suffered from a lack of numbers and a lack of experience. It was overly reliant on militia. So they march into Canada expecting very, very little, if any, resistance. Maybe not open arms, but didn't expect much of a fight, and they were repulsed. They did burn the governor's house in York, and it really, really shows that the American army lacked good leadership. They had bitten off really more than they could chew.
Okay.
And we end up with quite an inconsequential skirmish around the Great Lakes. The British wanted to use the Native Americans around the Great Lakes as their ally. Really what they wanted, the British, was a nice buffer zone created as a sort of Native American reservation between the United States of America and Canada, there to sort of protect their sovereignty.
Okay.
So we end up with inconsequential skirmishes. It's not successful. The Americans are not able to invade and successfully capture and hold Canada. It just doesn't work out that way.
Okay.
I think that what it proves is militia were great during the American Revolution, great in terms of defense, but by this point, militia are not really interested in offensive action, and nor are they competent at it.
So there's no United States Army to speak of here.
It's very, very small. All the experienced officers from the American Revolution have gone, and I think the key point here is they can't rely on foreign intervention to bolster their ranks anymore. Rochambeaus of the American Revolution are gone. They're really left to their own devices, and they're starved of that experience. The British aren't much better off. Most of their manpower and troops and focus is in Europe, trying to protect their homeland. So the British only have about 5,000 soldiers in Canada in 1812. So not many.
Huh.
Not many. They actually rely on loyalist sort of militia support of their own, I suppose.
Okay, so that would come from primarily Upper Canada, I would have thought.
Yes, Upper Canada. But what it does mean is by the end of the Napoleonic Wars, once that's done and dusted, the British are then able to ship over loads of ships, vessels, and battle-hardened, experienced soldiers from the continent over to America. So as the war goes on, the British get stronger, which is a bit of a sort of reverse of the American Revolution.
Yeah.
Where after 1777, they had to ship men back because the French and Spanish had come in on the American side. So that's quite interesting.
Okay,
as time went on, the British grow stronger.
Sure. Okay, is there a battle other than one that you might have already said? Is there a battle where we can say, look, that really is the crux of this war?
I think in 1814, when the British invade Washington, the capital, they really want to teach the Americans a lesson here. Neither side has enough resources to make this battle tell. This was never a battle for national survival for either side. Bit of a sideshow, but they do march into Washington. What they really want to do is extract a fine or a levy from the Americans there. The Americans don't pay. Someone shoots on the British soldiers. They then, whilst respecting private property, they didn't sabotage and ransack the town. This was quite a surgical operation in Washington.
Right.
The militia break and run. We know that Dolly Madison, the president's wife, the first lady, was able to save...
Madison?
Yeah, she was able...
Wonderful name.
She was apparently able to save the portrait of Washington, the original Declaration of Independence, and some of the documents from the original Continental Congress. So those sacred documents to America were saved, but the British torch the White House and then leave.
Wow. Okay, that's phenomenal. These are things I had no idea about.
Yeah, so that's really, really interesting. I mean, the fact we're sort of trying to pick wars here proves that this was quite an inconsequential war. It's difficult to follow it in a sort of linear trajectory.
Okay.
I suppose the biggest battle, the one that's the most prominent in American psyche, happens after the actual Treaty of Ghent is signed towards the end of 1814. That's the peace treaty between the Americans and the British.
Okay, why Ghent?
I've got no idea, actually. But what I do know is, before news of it has reached the Americas, we have the Battle of New Orleans, where the British are essentially trying to control the Gulf of Mexico. There is a battle there, and the Americans actually win.
Hmm.
So the actual biggest battle of the war probably happened after the war had finished.
Wow.
But the one, I suppose another one that sticks in American memory is the attack on Fort McHenry in Baltimore. The British laid siege to that for over 24 hours, bombarded the hell out of it. They couldn't have an amphibious landing. The militia were out in strength. The British resorted to naval bombardment, relying on their naval strength, bombarded Fort McHenry, but it stood. They didn't relinquish the flag. That's where the anthem comes from.
Okay, right. I'm going to just quickly jump in here. You've got just over 2 minutes left. You mentioned that this war is something of a sideshow or is inconsequential. I'm going to jump now to consequences. I've just got one very specific question about consequences. I don't know whether you'll be able to answer this. Usually wars, or not usually, but often wars, the outcomes of war are usually described in terms of losses. Do we know how many men were killed in these battles?
Not many. The British didn't have a huge force there. As far as I'm aware, there weren't actually that many men killed. There were 100 British vessels in US waters by 1814.
Right.
So in terms of actual losses, they weren't that significant because there weren't that many significant big battles during the war.
All right. Well, let's
the consequences are far more interesting.
Right. Let me ask that question then. If you were to pick two or three consequences, what might they be?
Okay, I think Canada was never ever to join the United States of America. That sets that in stone. Canada is not going to become part of the USA as much as Thomas Jefferson thought it would be. It proved this was not there for the marching.
Okay.
The Canadians would never become America. We know that the next big attack on the sort of American homeland was going to be 46,357 days later with the attack on Pearl Harbor, or in other words 6,622 weeks 3 days later. So that really does punctuate the consciousness of America in the, probably in a sort of similar way to the War of 1812. So the attack on the White House certainly burnt the soul of many Americans, was seen as a national humiliation, and Pearl Harbor coming in World War II sometime later sort of probably does punctuate their consciousness in a similar, if not the same way.
Okay.
What we do know is USS Constitution, the famous battleship from that war, is still actually a commissioned US Navy vessel, and it's moored in Boston Harbor. So to actually serve on that today, it's permanently moored, is an honor for any US naval personnel.
Is it a sail ship?
It's a sail ship. It's called Old Ironsides. This really does restore some US pride in their Navy, a small Navy, because the British tried to attack it on numerous occasions, but could never actually do so. And it's known as Old Ironsides. When the British fired at it, the cannibals just bounced off.
Okay.
So the Americans didn't have many ships, but the USS Constitution must go down in history as one of the most famous and one of the sort of beloved ornaments of US nationhood, I suppose.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. You've got 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Okay, the American anthem is obviously key. We spoke about that, so I won't dwell on it too long. But what we do know is the Native Americans definitely suffer. As the big loser of this war is that are the Native Americans there. The Native American links with Britain that had sort of been there since the end of the American Revolution are now shattered. Uh-huh. The Creeks were attacked in the South by Andrew Jackson, who would later go on to become American president. It's after this war, really, that American expansion accelerates. We know in 1803, President Jefferson purchased, I'm going to have to ignore your beat because I think this is key. President Jefferson had purchased the territory of Louisiana from the French government for $15 million in 1803.
Louisiana purchase.
Louisiana purchase. And that means American territory is going to stretch from the Mississippi River to the Rocky Mountains, from Canada to New Orleans, and it doubled the size of the United States. But by 1840, nearly 7 million Americans, or 40% of the nation's population, lived in the Trans-Appalachian West. So what this end of this war really does, it's more correlation than maybe causation or consequence, but this really does signal the turning point in American expansionism. If we think about King George's line of proclamation, 1763, where settlement west of the Appalachians had been prohibited, that irked many Americans, one of the causes of the American Revolution. But after the War of 1812, what we really do see is American size growing in terms of geography, and the American quest westward really, really kicking in.
So this is where we see the return to manifest destiny and westward expansion.
Yeah, I think so, in geographical terms. But it also, you know what, for the Americans, they've just taken on the superpower of its day, who've just defeated, you know, the French, and they've held their own. They've not been beaten. This war ends in a draw. And after the actual war ended officially, even though they weren't aware of the Battle of New Orleans, that was really a victory for the Americans.
Right, okay.
So this really does set in stone some of those national narratives, if you will, which still last today. Think about American classrooms. They salute the flag.
Yes, they do.
They all know the national anthem, Declaration of Independence, very, very important. Well, this really sort of re-ratifies the Declaration of Independence. Britain's had another go. It maybe didn't want to... I don't think any British people really thought they were going to get 13 colonies back, but you know, Britain's had another nibble and they've not been successful. They've not been able to swallow. They've chewed on it and they've been stung. And
fantastic.
You know, after that, America's definitely independent. It's been re-ratified is the term I like to use.
Okay. I'm going to give you 30 more seconds and then we're going to call this a day. Anybody interested in finding out more, or this has whetted the appetite for more information on the War of 1812, where would you suggest a student might go to find out, you know, a little bit more?
Okay, I think the first place you want to go to is the official National Park Service Handbook of the War of 1812. Now, I picked this up when I was in Arlington Cemetery in Washington, obviously an area of significance for most Americans. I picked this book up there. It's short, it's accessible, it's great. There are not too many books on it because it's often seen as a bit of a sort of sideshow. Uh-huh. But I would, if you want an accessible, interesting, short book that covers everything from its impact on Native Americans to the global context to Madison to the land operations to the legacies and its relationship with Canada, you want to go to this book. It's cheap, it's accessible, it's great. And I've got it right in front of me. I'll tweet out a little picture on Versus History for you so you can see it. Why not pick it up? It's about $10. Great bargain.
Well, that was brilliant, Pat. I know a heck of a lot more about the War of 1812 than I did before. I particularly like the detail about Dolly Madison saving the Declaration of Independence and that kind of stuff. That's wonderful information. So I think we'll draw a line under that. So once again, thank you very much, Pat. It is goodbye from me.
It's goodbye from me. And if you've got any questions on the War of 1812, tweet us at Versus History. If I don't know, I'll send Elliot to look it up for you. All
brilliant.
The best. Thank
okay.
you.
Ta-da.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe. Visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.